So, Mom, what went into raising me as a child? I mean, what was your plan, and what did you do to make sure you were raising a person who was a good, active, and informed citizen who will be responsible and conscious of who he was?
Well, I guess that kind of interaction with you started when you were very young, where literally something as small as teaching you to clean up after yourself, even as a young child. And from that, basically, parenting is just taking the small responsibilities that you can share with your child and then continuously enlarging those responsibilities until he or she becomes self-sufficient. So that's what I did with you, and you were always, I guess I would say, very trainable in that way. You always took on the responsibility for your belongings and for the person that you are and your spot in society, your place in society. And to me, that's what was important to me, was that first you take on the responsibility for your own being, then you take on the responsibility for being active in other people's lives in terms of being kind and patient and empathetic and conscious of some other people's needs and how possibly you could interact with them and supply those needs.
So how did you nurture that? How did you nurture me being, empathetic and caring about the needs of other people?
Well, every opportunity that I had to point out to you that you should consider somebody else's feelings, I brought that up. And sometimes you would just come to me and explain situations that were occurring. And then we would emphasize that, wow, that must have been whatever for that person to have felt that way. Can you imagine what it would be like if that happened to you? Oftentimes, that's what I ended up doing, was sometimes you might have done something that I didn't agree with and I was disapproving of, and then I would reflect that back to you. What if someone did you like that? Or what if someone told you an untruth, like sometimes you might have been telling me as a young child?
You trying to say I was a liar?
I'm saying that a lot of times you did things to be untruthful and embellish what reality really was. And yes, you intentionally was misleading. Yes.
I think you're lying.
Okay. That's your opinion.
One of my most famous lies was when asked who messed up my room. And I said it was Tony Dorsett. Not only was Tony Dorsett a famous football player at the time, he was also the name of my gerbil. So other than lying, I mean, what were some of your concerns that you had when I was growing up?
I basically just wanted a couple of main things. I wanted you to understand that being responsible for yourself was the epitome of being a good person. That would be number one. Number two, that you should take on a place in the community, that you should be responsible for other people to some degree, that you take on responsibility as being a community member, that you are able to actually be self-sufficient, and that you abstain from those kinds of behaviors that would cause you most likely to be imprisoned or possibly addicted to drugs. Those were my fears as a parent, and those were things that I always wanted you to understand, that these are things that I'm trying to keep you away from, and then therefore the things that I'm trying to steer you towards.
And so what went into that? I mean, did you have a plan when you were raising me, or what was the plan? steer me away from drugs, to steer me away from prison and things of that nature.
I think part of my plan was obviously to point out situations that could possibly lead to those mishaps. So if you were, you know, doing something that I was disapproving of, I would point out that, no, you can't do that because the consequences could end up being that you would be putting yourself in peril. So also I think it was a great deal of my life during your childhood was trying to be a good model to you and making sure that you were surrounded by people who were good role models. Not only that people who would basically preach what should be, but also learn that they actually walk the walk, talk the talk, and walk the walk. So I made sure that the influences in your life were of a positive nature.
And what would be some of those influences that you kept around?
Well, for example, I felt that my mother was a great influence. She was very interested in you, and she was very instrumental in making sure that you were the person that we all would be proud of as you, not only when you grew up, but as you were growing. And she did that also by role modeling herself. She was a teacher, and she role modeled that education was quite important. She role modeled that it was very important that you get your education, that you do all the things that you needed to do on a daily basis to not just get good grades, but to be a good learner. And I think that you have become a lifelong learner. That I mean, I still see that in you, that you continue to learn. Whether you're in school or not, I see you as a lifelong learner.
What are some stories that resonates with you when it comes to me learning, you know, about life and whatnot? Some stories that, you know, you hold true to your heart and that you think about often when it comes to me.
Well, I guess one of the big stories that I would think of is that at a young age, you had this little ice cream truck that my mother had bought you, and you used to take it up to the store, the neighborhood store. When we would go, you might take it up to the neighborhood store, and I remember one day we had gone up to the store and you had decided to put an ice cream bar inside your ice cream truck, your little cart, and it was something that escaped us and we did not end up paying for it. So essentially it was stolen.
So you basically said I shoplifted.
You basically shoplifted. And not only was it from the neighborhood store, but it was from a dear friend, the owner of the... Yes, Mr. Holmes was the owner of the store. But you were only like three. But this was a time that I guess we would call a teachable moment. At this point, that's what we would call that. But of course, we discovered it when we got back down to the house, which it was only about a block away, realized that you had stolen this ice cream treat. And so of course, we made a big deal of it and explained that you don't steal, you don't, if you didn't pay for something, or I didn't pay for something, or my mother hadn't paid for it, then that is stealing and that is absolutely wrong. So we went back up there and had you to explain to Mr. Holmes that you had stolen this and that you were sorry. And you know, it was great because it was literally an example of it taking a village, because Mr. Holmes went along with kind of a role play where he explained to you, you know, you could be taken to jail for this, and and not be with your mom and your grandmother and so forth.
But
and
I feel like it was you guys' fault because y'all gave me an ice cream truck and, you know, didn't teach me how to make ice cream or anything. So, I mean, that's what goes into an ice cream truck. I didn't really see it as. I thought it was, you know.
Well, and in all honesty, like I said, you were very young. And some of the time what we were doing is like we might have some sort of ice cream at home, some sort of ice cream treat at home or a popsicle or something. And yeah, we would put it in your ice cream truck.
Are you sure that he didn't hear me when I said put this on my tab?
I'm sure because you didn't say anything about a tab. You did not have a tab. You wouldn't have not understood that. You completely stole and it was just.
I didn't steal it. I discovered it.
Well, in your mind at 3 years old, I'm sure you didn't feel like you were stealing, but it was an opportunity for us to teach you that you don't take without paying. And it also meant that you've got to have a manner in which you get money, which ultimately, you know, it went from a three-year-old to like a 14-year-old realizing I'd like to get certain shoes and my mom is only going to give me a certain amount of money towards them, so I'm going to have to go out and get me a job so that I can supplement what she's going to provide to get the things that I actually wanted. So you started working at a very early age, and I mentioned that particular job because it was actually for an outside employer. However, you had actually organized prior to that a private enterprise with you and one of your little buddies where you actually did odd jobs around the community, and you guys had a price list and everything, and you went around soliciting neighbors asking if you could mow their lawn, rake their grass, take out the garbage, clean their cars and so forth. And I thought it was a pretty good enterprise, and it was very creative on your part, and it really showed a lot of initiative.
Yeah, I had to talk my best friend at the time, Justin, out of. He had put exotic dancing on there too for birthday parties, and I took that off. I said, "Man, I don't really want to take anything off. I just want to mow lawns and wash cars and whatnot." But that was my chance to be Magic Mike. So talk about what it was, you know, raising a child who was in special education, who was deemed and defined as hyperactive when it came to learning. Talk about that.
Well, it was actually, I believe that, yes, you've always been a very active person. You continue to be high energy type person. You have to have a variety of focuses, interests, so forth, just to keep you stimulated. And that's just the nature of the person that you are. Unfortunately, all of the education center system, especially back then when you were coming up, was not in tune to that type of child, nor is it necessarily even currently. The public education system is not necessarily equipped to deal with active young learners. And so we had to keep you busy. I mean, at one point we were putting you in special ed, not necessarily because you had a learning disability, but mostly because the education center system could not keep up with the manner in which you learned, because it was still kind of centered on what I would consider a traditional or conventional classroom type setting, where mostly the teacher was up at the front, things were on the blackboard, and you know the student was directed to the teacher or to something in the book and didn't have to, you know, learn from that kind of a system. That was not necessarily the best kind of system for you. And so, unfortunately, at a pretty early age, it was suggested that you be put on some sort of medication to address hyperactivity. And I had decided that that was not something that I wanted to do. I felt that the energy level that you displayed could be honed into a positive experience for you. And I think that all of the things that you do now, all the different activities and interests that you pursue at this point in life, I think it proves that I was in the right on the right track, even when you were a young learner.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess it makes sense that now I'm an educator. Now I'm a principal, and that's something that needs to be, you know, investigated a lot more. Is dealing with the hyperactivity or just the high level of energy, especially with males, but especially black and brown males, because, you know, that's the characteristics of strong leaders. You know, when we talk about, you know, people who are able to multitask and do certain things, but, you know, when they were younger, they were diagnosed with ADD or ADHD, but that ability to perform many different tasks at one time is something that needs to be seen as a strength rather than an area of growth. And that goes into the curriculums and the pedagogy of our teachers at a young age. Talk about some of the other things that you had me do as a basic way, you know, to create this competition with things that you didn't want me to do, like the sports you had me in, different activities and things of that nature.
Yeah, that was another thing that I was thinking about, was to use that energy in a structured manner in the pursuit of athletics. And it seemed that the baseball was...
Just the baseball?
The sport of baseball.
Not just the baseball.
The sport of baseball. I believe that the sport of baseball is what you truly gravitated towards and you excelled in. And I think that was really a good move to have you involved in that sport. That was a good thing for you.
What are some other things? I remember ballet. I remember
you were
karate.
You were in ballet for a short time. You did karate.
I remember I tried basketball when I was younger, but didn't start playing until I got older.
Right.
And tennis.
Yeah, tennis was another thing.
Football once I got into high school.
Right. Yeah, football was something that you really wanted to do at an even earlier age, but I have to admit that I was the one that kind of fought that, because I just thought that football, and I still think that football is a very dangerous sport.
It is. Yeah, it is. I remember that. You never would let me play football, nor would you never let me play with toy guns.
That's correct.
Why?
I disagree with young people playing with toy guns. Even before I became a police officer.
And start taking me to the range and shooting real guns. But go ahead.
But here again, the emphasis was taken away from toy. It was not a toy. It was shown respect as a weapon. Something that, yeah, it could be something that could be fun in target practice and so forth. And it could be something that you learn to be proficient at and therefore increase your self-esteem and your confidence. But there was a definite respect that had to be learned about a gun. And for me, presenting it as a toy, a gun as a toy, was in direct contrast to saying that this is a real thing that can have grave consequences and that it has to be treated with high respect.
And that's something that, you know, I borrowed and, you know, from you and your parenting, and that's something that I definitely did with my children too. Could never play with toy guns. You mentioned being a police officer. Let's talk about some of your accomplishments and your humble beginnings. Every time I see the movie The Help, or I see an advertisement, I think of you. So talk about those beginnings of, you know, cleaning other people's homes, and then your progression of jobs that you had?
Well, yes, there were times that I worked in people's homes as what they called back then a domestic worker, which means that basically I cleaned homes. And yes, I did that when you were quite young. I went out and cleaned homes to make some money. I've done some other things, such as I've worked at a church, and I did what they called an outreach program, a community ministry type program. I, from there, went on and got a job with the Ohio State Trooper as a trooper, and I worked there for about a year and a half. And I aspired to do something other than working the highways and giving people speeding tickets and things. So I decided to become a police officer in the city of Seattle, was successful in procuring that job, and stayed with that until I retired from the police department. And then upon retirement from there, I decided that I wanted to work with young people in a more positive manner, hopefully before they actually encountered or became ingrained in the criminal justice system. So I started working as a security officer in a middle school. So I've been doing that since I retired from the Seattle Police Department.
So talk about your accomplishments as a police officer. I know you had to be one of the first black female police officers with Seattle Police Department.
So when I became a police officer with the Seattle Police Department, I was literally the 10th black female that had been hired by them. So, and then what's interesting, of course, I mean, you know, there's some turnover and so forth. And by the end of my career there, I found out that I was the first black female officer who retired, who did a service retirement. There were other officers or people who had different ranks, and they had worked with the police department and left it, but not with a service retirement. So that was something that was kind of interesting, that I had been number 10 black female officer with Seattle, and then actually the first black female officer who left with a service retirement. Working for the Seattle Police Department was an invaluable experience, truly, in that because it is such a large department with lots of different units in it, I was able to do a lot of different jobs within that department. So that was really interesting, and it was just a very good experience. It really helped me to become a more confident person and very experienced in certain areas of law enforcement.
So when I think about you growing up, I think about your accomplishments, and you always were the person who could fix anything. I used to bring my toys to fix. We used to play catch. Of course, you were police officers, and a lot of your accomplishments growing up, you really did a good job of, you know, raising me healthy in a way that, you know, within reason, you know, whatever a man can do, a woman can do also, you know. But, and a lot of your accomplishments define what it means to be a feminist, but you never ever adopted the name. As far as I know, none of the women in my family growing up adopted the title of a feminist, but they always were empowering. I always tell people that I was raised in a matriarch. So how come you never adopted the name, or what is your relationship with that title?
Well, I never considered myself a feminist, and I would have to say that it's because I identify myself as a black woman first. And through the teachings that I learned when I was growing up, the obstacle that was to be overcome are the challenges, the special challenges that would be presented to me would be because of my race rather than my gender or my sex. So that never really entered my mind that I was a feminist. For me, because I think of the teachings of my mother, she would always say things like, you've got to be better or the best that you can be because you are black. And for me, that's what it was all about. And secondly, I would say that the things that I did and the accomplishments that you have given me credit for were basically me trying to meet the demands that were put on my specific life. So a lot of the time when you were growing up, I was not with a man. So it meant that if something needed to be fixed, I needed to try to do it. I was also taught by my mom, don't depend on anybody to do something for you that you can do for yourself. So a lot of times, that's what I tried to do. Oftentimes, because I can remember once you had this bicycle. In fact, it was the very first bicycle you had. And I had gotten it from a store. I can't remember what store, but it was in a box, and I had to put it together. You had it for a Christmas gift, and I had put it together. And I can remember that the handlebars were on backwards, and I didn't realize it until you took it outside and some of the other kids said, ha ha, your handlebars are on backwards. And you were like, Mom, they told me my handlebars are on backwards. So, I mean, I think that you were really forgiving in a lot of the mistakes that I made, because for some reason you were so influenced by the fact that I would try or did it, and therefore that seemed to overshadow that maybe I didn't do it exactly right, because it was kind of like, I think that I ended up being the person, the go-to person that, well, I'll go get my mom to do it because she'll do it for me. And I think it was more me being motivated to provide for you in whatever way it was, rather than I necessarily knew how to do it.
So how did you navigate yourself, going back to the police department, being a black woman in the police department, knowing that, you know, racial profiling exists and institutional racism exists? Like, how did you navigate that? Because I remember one time you had told me that I should always be on my best behavior around your colleagues, because one of your fears is that one of your white colleagues would, you know, do something to hurt me. So make sure that you always, you know, behave yourself properly and don't put yourself in, you know, in jeopardy of, you know, being a recipient of that kind of treatment.
Correct. I mean, and maybe part of that was because I was aware, because of my profession, but I think that even without that awareness, I would have taught you, as I have your brothers, that there are certain ways that you have to conduct yourself when you are interacting with a law enforcement officer. And I have been very diligent in trying to explain to you what the best responses are in certain situations. And I think that that's what I needed to do as a parent, as a mom. In the same sense, kind of getting back to the initial question you asked me, I know that there had been many times for many years that I really questioned whether or not I wanted to continue to be a police officer because of the dichotomy of feelings that I had about law enforcement in the Black community, or just law enforcement in general, not just the Black community, but, you know, the authority to put someone in jail, the authority to literally detain a person and to keep them from being a free person. We could detain a person and they could no longer just walk around freely, to put a person in handcuffs and stuff. So the way I resolved that was that I thought, okay, because I have these sensitivities and I keep them at the forefront with also doing the best job I can as a law enforcement officer, because the tempered with these sensitivities, then that's going to make me the kind of law enforcement officer that I can be proud of, and the kind that I can defend myself as to, no, I don't agree with everything that a police officer has to do, but I understand the necessity of police officers.
So how did that shape your practice or your performance as a police officer when it came to dealing with, you know, suspects or citizens and things of that nature?
I tried not to be demeaning. I always tried to be very respectful of people. I tried to be empathetic. I feel that because I was 30 when I became a Seattle police officer, that it helped me because I was already a mature person who had experienced a lot of life. I had been a single parent, so I possibly was not as judgmental as some people that might be only 21 and not have had a family type experience, having responsibilities as a parent or anything. So I think that it helped me to be a person who could put in perspective, well, this is possibly why a person may be displaying the behavior that I'm seeing. And all behavior that is disapproving is not unlawful.
Recently, we've been, you know, hit with a lot of instances in the media with, you know, white officers killing unarmed Black men, which has spurred like the whole Black Lives Matter movement and things of that nature. Why does it seem like there isn't a large amount of Black officers killing unarmed white suspects, but there are a lot of white officers killing unarmed Black suspects?
Well, I mean, I can't say that I can speak out of an informed opinion on this, because I haven't really studied this issue or looked at the stats. But even
your experience as a police officer.
Initially, what I would have to say is, depending on the locale, you're probably going to have a lot more situations where the white officers actually outnumber the Black officers. Other than that, I'd have to say that I seriously would have to take each incident separately and as a unique occurrence, because there are so many times when I hear things in the news, and if I look at it as a police officer, I can understand how a police officer would react in the manner in which that police officer did.
Let's switch gears, because, you know, I was talking about unarmed Black men being killed by white officers. That's been in the news a lot. But also what's been in the news recently is marriage equality that's been accomplished by making it legal for same-sex marriages across the country. And, you know, in our family, that was it's very dear to us, because your brother, my uncle, passed away. He was homosexual, and he passed away because he contracted AIDS and HIV. and passed away. But how did your relationship with Askia and his homosexual life ultimately, and his ultimate untimely death, I should say, impact your view on homosexuality?
I would have to say that when someone you love discloses to you something about themselves, whether it's homosexuality or whatever, something that you may have had either no opinion on because literally ignorant of, or because you felt that you had not had any exposure to, so therefore you had no reason to have an opinion on it. But when someone you love discloses to you something that you may have been judgmental about, I think oftentimes that love transcends the judgment. And I can recall that when my brother told me that he was homosexual, although my understanding was not full, as it is not yet even today, I knew that my acceptance and level of empathy would have to be changed because I would continue to love my brother no matter what.
Yeah, and I think it, even for me, it was even more significant because the whole time it was kept hidden from me that he was homosexual, until the point that he had gotten sick, and then, you know, it was hard to keep that hidden, because then I started asking so many questions. But here is a man who, you know, who pretty much introduced, you know, the culture and the pride of being black and being proud of, you know, who you are and the melanin in your skin and the history and the culture that comes from it. And there's no way in the world that I could swap that out and be like, oh, my whole admiration towards this man has to be, you know what I'm saying, canceled out and neutralized because he's gay. And like you said, to be honest with you, I think I was raised pretty healthy in the fact that I really didn't have too much of an opinion on it in the beginning. I mean, we were raised in a household where we didn't, you know, say any slurs, you know what I'm saying? So, there's always the occasional joke that you have. If you ever want to slander someone or put someone down, you always, you know, say they're gay or something like that. But,
and back then it wouldn't have been that you said they were gay.
It wouldn't, yeah. You just, you know, you might, you know, lose some kind of homophobic, you know, slur. Like, I remember, you know, mom would say punk or something. That had a whole
different meaning than what it has now.
Punk meant you were gay, or, you know, faggot or something like that. But I really didn't have too much to say on it. I really didn't think about it, you know. But, you know, when I found out, you know, it definitely forced me, because I am a learner, you know what I'm saying, and things have to make sense to me. It definitely, quote unquote, I'll casually use the word, forced me to modify my thinking, you know, and try to understand. And it's something that, you know, I continue to, you know, learn how to be, you know, proficient in, you know, better, you know, at understanding it as being, you know, a heterosexual male with privilege. You know, I am a passive participant in that. So that's how it's impacted me. And you're right, when you love someone and, you know, you overlook all that, now you want to understand more about what goes into that person's life as a homosexual. What impact did he say, or what was Skia talk about, you know, his homosexual life and race? How did that play a part? Because he was very, very race conscious person. So how did that play a role? Like, how did he How did he speak upon that when it came to those two things, race and homosexuality? Did he tie anything to racism or white supremacy or anything of that nature?
Well, you know, really, even within the homosexual setting or culture, he was still very aware of whether or not a black man was being oppressed by a white man. And I think there was a consciousness about that, that he wanted to address in his daily living. So a lot of that, I think, even was how he conducted himself, you know, how he conducted himself with self-respect and love for self and self-knowledge and his awareness of his culture in terms of the African heritage, not specific to his genealogy, but to black men in general. So he had a great awareness of what blackness meant, what the African heritage meant. And he was willing to educate you, his nephews, about those things and to share that with other people that he knew. I mean, I know that he also shared that with white people that he knew. He had a lot of friends who happened to be Caucasian, but they just happened to be Caucasian. They were his friends, but he never shied away from explaining and educating them to this is the black experience, whether it be present day for him or something of a cultural heritage.
Moving along, so when we think about his influence on me and your other sons, like, what part of Askia do you see most in your children?
Well, I would have to say that you're my only child who knew Askia to the degree that you could say I knew the person Askia. I knew my uncle. Foster was exposed to him only until he was about 3 years old. And then, unfortunately, he didn't have that. So, and in addition to that, those were years that, you know, 3 years old and prior to that, you tend not to remember that as a child. And in addition, those were not his most vibrant years because he was already sick. But you had the opportunity to know him as a real uncle, to know him as a person who interacted with you, that did all the uncle, the older uncle kinds of things, like, you know, torture you also, playfully, of course. But he also taught you many things, and I do believe that you always admired him and looked at him as a role model. And you are the only son that I have that had that opportunity to look at my brother as his role model.
And what do you think you see in me most that reminds you of Askia?
I would say a black awareness, a self-understanding of who you are as a man and as a black man, your cultural heritage, that cultural heritage that is specific to you, what you've actually lived and experienced, but also those things that you did not personally live, but is a part of your African heritage. I feel that you're deciding to adopt a different name once you started to adopt a certain lifestyle that you wanted to adhere to. I think that was a great influence from him. I would say a responsibility to being purely who you are is something that you got from him. Meaning that without pretense or without trying to strictly model yourself after somebody else. I think it's like you being your own man you got from him.
Unique. Being unique.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Edit this part. I forgot what I was gonna say. Let's talk about the name change. Askia went through a name change. Before he was Askia, he was Guy, and before I was Logic, I was Pierre. And I've made a lot of different changes, you know, spirituality wise. How did you? What were you thinking when I started to go through all these different changes? Like, how did you deal with it? Emotionally and whatnot, just me, all the different changes that I've gone through when it comes to spirituality, which comes to political views and or whatnot.
Well, when I first saw you going towards this adopting a certain culture, lifestyle, spiritual stance, your understanding of the world, how you fit in the world, how your family fits in the world. What really, the very first thing I can recall that struck me was how you felt that elders are to be honored. And I can remember that when you were probably 18 or 19. I would say probably 19 is when it really hit me. And I just realized from there that you have had adopted this philosophy that elders had a special place in the family and in the community structure. And I really liked that. And I thought, well, he wants to be, I think you were saying you were a 5%er at that point. And I thought, I don't know all of what that is, but I sure am liking a whole lot of it. And I liked a lot of the restrictions and, I guess, self-discipline that you adhered to. I liked that. I could definitely see that you were coming up with identifying what structure you were going to adopt as an adult. And everything that I saw, I liked. Because it wasn't hinged on going out and getting high or, you know, shooting crap or hanging on the corner or seeing how many bars you could hop. That's not the information that I heard coming from you. And when you went over to the University of Washington, I saw a lot of going towards the Black Student Union, being involved in that. And I remember going to programs where you were doing a lot of the spoken word, and I liked that. And I just saw a lot of maturing and a lot of you defining the person who you are.
Yeah, but you also nurtured that too, because I remember distinctly you always being a Christian, but always being very liberal in your interpretation of the Bible and things of that nature. I remember we used to talk about parables and allegories and how he spoke in stories and how some things in the Bible are metaphorical. They're not actually literal. And I can also remember you taking me to see some of the ministers from the Nation of Islam and introducing me to Kwanzaa. What was it, you being a Christian, and what was it that made you have that liberal feeling when it came to religion? You wasn't always bound into the same script that I hear a lot of Christians, if you don't get saved, you're going to go to hell, and, you know, Jesus is a white man, or, you know, Goliath was really 8 foot tall, you know what I'm saying? He got cleared with his slingshot. It was always, those were parables, you know, you could always look both ways. What went into you having such a liberal understanding of what it is to be a Christian?
Well, for me, I really based my approach to life and my approach to, I guess, exposing you and setting up expectations that I have for you, that basically it's really a simple thing. I wanted you to be a good person. And I tend to believe, even though I may have adopted Christianity as my way to be a good person, to way I set up the standard and discipline myself, I feel, and I know there are a lot of Christians that disagree, but I feel that my way is not the only way. And for me, if you could adopt a lifestyle where you were a good person, you were good to yourself, you were a good father once you became a father, you were a good community member, you knew how to be empathetic to people, you knew how to be good to a woman, then to me, you're on the right track. Now, if down the road you decide you wanted to be Christian, I'd be really good with that. And that's what I exposed you to coming up. But like I said, I also understood that all I'm doing is setting the foundation, and that as you grow, you will determine what avenue you want to travel to get to where you need to be. And my main thing was, I just want you to know that where you want to be is to be a good person. Now, you may go down one street and I may go down another street, but for me, that didn't mean that that extinguished the fact that you are a good person, because you had to go my route.
What is it that you feel like you're most proud of that you accomplished, and then what is it that you're most proud of that I accomplished?
Well, I guess, you know, truthfully, I guess I could come up with some things that I did professionally. Going through the Ohio State Patrol was a very, very, very rigorous training. And at the end of that, I realized, oh my gosh, I did it. So short term, yeah, that might have been one thing. But truthfully, that was just a small piece of what all came together as a puzzle, as that these are experiences that make me who I am. These are experiences that maybe expose my weaknesses as well as expose my strengths. And a lot of the things that I did in my life, I did get to be exposed to a lot of strengths that I would not have had. I would not have given myself credit for had I not addressed those challenges. But in all of everything that I've done like that, I would say that truly it's not the professional things, but it's the relationship that I have with my children. The fact that I have three young men that are kind, good, conscious, empathetic people, and that, yes, even though they're not all exactly where they need to be, they are where they need to be for the age that they are. Because, I mean, I have a 19-year-old, a 22-year-old, 22. Yeah.
I think Foster's 23 now.
Oh, okay, that's right. He is 23. Okay, anyway, they all are where they need to be. There's nobody out of the three of you, there's no one that has strayed. And I think, oh my gosh. Do I still pray for you guys? Of course, absolutely. Do I have concerns? Yes. And some of my concerns are just anxiety-ridden, mother-like things. I get that. And I'm always going to be like that. But essentially, I'm the most proud of the people that you guys are. You're great, and you make me feel really good about who you are. And not proud because I'm your mom and I can take credit for it, but the fact that evidently, given the basis that I tried to give you, that you took what you needed from it and you progressed. And I like that.
So the thing that you're most proud of that I accomplished is that I'm a good person.
That you're a good person, but specifically that you're a great father. To me, that is like, oh my gosh. Because see, now being a great father, you're not just being responsible for yourself, but you're being responsible for your offspring, or as you say, your seed, what you are truly responsible for. In other words, those children, your seeds, would not be on this earth if it were not for you. Who else should you take responsibility for but those people? And you have. And that is just, I cannot express to you how overwhelmingly happy I am about how you have met the challenge in that area. You are a great father. You are.
Thanks, and you are a great mother. That's a great time to close this out, because now I have to go to my moonlighting job as a stripper. That's a joke. I strip paint. I strip paint. Not clothes. Thank you.